become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite, Facebook at facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited, YouTube at youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited, or bookmark our website at MovieGeeksUnited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/MovieGeeksUnited. Welcome to a special impromptu episode of Movie Geeks United. We're recording this roundtable discussion tonight on Monday, August 20th, 2012. Less than 24 hours ago, there was a news report that Tony Scott, one of the most successful directors in Hollywood, took his own life by jumping off the Vincent Thomas Suspension Bridge in San Pedro, California. More news has been coming out throughout the day. At first, it was reported that he might have had an inoperable brain tumor, which might have given some semblance of a motivation for his suicide. But now his family denies that. But we're not here to necessarily talk about his death. We're here to celebrate his body of work. And to do that, I am joined by Jerry and Aaron and our good friend Rick. So the first thing I want to know from all of you guys is, when you look at his body of work, what are your favorite films? Which ones mean the most to you guys? And I guess, Rick, you can start out by telling me your answer.
Yeah, you know, I really enjoyed a lot of his films, a lot. I mean, just growing up, I mean, I of course, like Top Gun. It's a fun movie. Mm-hmm. It's a male testosterone movie, and, you know, it's colorful and fast and loud, and, you know, I was a kid. That was fun. I enjoyed Beverly Hills Cop 2. I thought that was a, you know, stylish film. I loved Crimson Tide. I thought that was just a fun, edge-of-your-seat movie. All the way up to Unstoppable, you know, and I really liked Unstoppable a lot. I saw that with Jamie, and that even the night we saw it, I was like, wow, that's so good, you know, and I was so excited for his next film. He's made a lot of, you know, I enjoyed Enemy of the State, you know, he's made so many good movies. I feel like in a lot of respect, like you guys, I'm still in shock. I mean, he was definitely, I'm sure I'll say it repeatedly, he's definitely, you know, one of my favorites growing up. So.
Yeah. Aaron, what are your favorites among his work?
His peak was the back-to-back of True Romance and Crimson Tide, 93 and 95. He was really firing on all cylinders. And obviously, every time you read one of these stories that says Top Gun director Tony Scott, that's obviously his most successful film, the most lasting of all his films. And it's a fun movie, but to me, you know, his 80s stuff, which is only three movies, is not the stuff I return to. In the 90s, he really... You know, he was a director, I felt, who did, even though he always worked in disreputable genres, you know, cop buddy movies or just buddy movies or just, you know, underground, you know, gangster world movies, dark, you know, R-rated movies, I thought he got better. You know, he took all this disreputable subject matter, you know, the stuff that, so let's face it, none of this stuff was going to get nominated for Oscars, you know.
yeah.
But he put a... He put a high gloss on it, obviously, but he just because it wasn't, you know, reputable stuff didn't mean it had to be bad or be talked down to. And starting with The Last Boy Scout, you know, with a screenplay by Shane Black, I think Scott kind of, he turned his back on some of that 80s excess and kind of started, he did a satire of it with Last Boy Scout, and he said, you know, I'm going to do this over-the-top stuff, I'm going to do it the way I want to see it. And so you get True Romance, you get A Crimson Tide. And then in the, you know, in the aughts, you know, in this last decade, I mean, he was doing experimental stuff that visually that, you know, you wouldn't expect from a guy in his 60s. Everyone's talking, you know, all summer we've been hearing about how freaking with Killer Joe, you know, he's like 77, and people are saying, you know, this is a young, you know, this has the feel of a first-timer or a young director's movie. But Scott was doing stuff visually in Man on Fire and Domino that, you know, guys in their 60s weren't doing. And I wasn't particularly a fan of Man on Fire or Domino. I thought the visuals overwhelmed the stories. But I thought, I actually thought he was really starting to hone in on that stuff. Deja Vu has a tricky script that's kind of fun and B-movie-ish and gritty. It has a terrific car chase. And then really his last two movies, he was really kind of, he was really toning it down. He was still doing his little, you know, his little, you know, like, Jamie, I know you don't like his little subtitles on everything. But he was really, I mean, obviously, if you look at Pelham, it's nothing like Man on Fire or Domino. And he's really toning it down, and he's really letting the story and the visuals balance out. And Pelham and Unstoppable are really kind of spectacular, almost old-fashioned movies. I mean, there's a lot of practical visuals in there that, you know, it was kind of a no... Unstoppable is kind of a no-fat action movie. That's
very much, yeah.
1206, this is Connie Hooper. Are you there?
1206, over.
Just wanted to see how you boys are doing.
We're doing about 60 miles an hour, Connie.
Sorry? Frank, I don't understand.
We're going after your train.
1206, I'm not hearing you.
Your rear knuckle was left open, so if we can catch up, we can tie it on to our locomotive. Try and slow down 777.
Frank, you can't.
We already are.
That train's carrying 30,000 gallons of toxic chemicals. They had a window before, but that train's going into populated areas. There's no way they derail it now.
Are you sure about that?
I think that's the most efficient, effective movie he's ever done. And that was exactly what I thought when I walked out of Unstoppable with you, Rick. I mean, I was like, that is one lean movie. I mean, that goes in there. It doesn't even have a second act, really. I mean, the train starts to get out of control and it's running away from them. They catch the train. They try to catch the train. That's the movie, and it's so expertly done. I thought it stood among his very best, like the most enjoyable of any of his works. So Jerry, what are you, I know True Romance has to be up
it
there
would
for
be
you.
Up there, but I would have to say the first. I mean, I'm a fan of The Hunger. I won't lie to you. I think The Hunger still remains one of David Bowie's really truly great performances. But no, The Last Boy Scout, first and foremost. It's everything that The Last Action Hero tried to be, but it's a vicious satire of the whole genre because it's just so over the top, just so outrageous, but it also works. I was always hoping they'd make a sequel to that because I thought that was definitely one of Bruce Willis's best characters. Obviously, True Romance. I'd like to talk about Unstoppable because if that's obviously the last film. I mean, that's an incredible film. And it's also, you know, we talk about all these partnerships. What about the Tony Scott Denzel Washington partnership?
That was a rich partnership. That was gearing up to be like the Scorsese De Niro. I mean, that was like another great director actor partnership.
And
absolutely.
I think Man on Fire or Unstoppable are my favorites. I think Man on Fire is a very underrated film. It's a very challenging film. It's got a great supporting cast too. I think Domino, he's really trying to outdo Tarantino, and among other things in that film. And it doesn't always work, but it is a lot of fun. It's nice to see Mickey Rourke. Obviously, it's great to see Keira Knightley really playing against type. That's a lot of fun too. I think the only film I'm not really crazy about is The Fan. At the end of the day, I think is the only one I'm not, wild about. But he made, let's say, when you were going to see a Tony Scott film, 9 times out of 10, you were going to be entertained.
Oh, yeah.
It was very rare that you were going to be disappointed. There's also another thing I was thinking about this today. Well, Ridley's work did not seep into his it is amazing that there are some pictures that Ridley Scott did that you say, hey, this could be, this is like Tony's influenced him. Body of Lies, Black Rain to a lesser extent, Thelma and Louise.
G.I. Jane is a total Tony Scott film.
I mean, yes. It's amazing that how really Ridley was more influenced by him than the other way around. Because you do see that at times throughout Ridley's career. Wow, you know, these are, this, you would think, wow, this is more like a Tony Scott film than a Ridley Scott movie.
Yeah. Well, my thoughts on Tony Scott, I do have a couple of that I consider definite favorites.
Mm-hmm.
An Unstoppable is one, True Romance, mm-hmm. and then Crimson Tide is definitely the other. And then the other films that populate his career, but I enjoy the vast majority of them, but
mm-hmm.
to a lesser extent than those top three
right.
for me. But what strikes me about his style, because when you talk Tony Scott, the first thing that comes to mind is that visual style. It's very distinctive. Is as he got older, and Aaron was kind of speaking to this, with Man on Fire and the movies around this period to the end of his life, he became more of an avant-garde filmmaker. But the level of visual experimentation in his movies was incredibly brave.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I thought, as I did it with Man on Fire, that it tended to derail the movie by just the nature of calling attention to itself or feeling unnecessary
mm-hmm.
at times. But even though I thought that, I always admired his bravery to push it as far as he possibly could. And for a mainstream filmmaker, for a filmmaker that has a lot of money on the line, he wants to get the butts in the seats for the opening weekend. For him to have that sense of experimentation is something very rare. And I do think that Denzel provided some of his best work in under Tony Scott's direction.
Denzel, and it's funny, you know, it was like almost a 9-year gap between Crimson Tide and Man on Fire. In Man on Fire, you know, Denzel's just coming off of a Training Day. And, of course, everyone talked about how he played a villain, bad guy. But here, you know, I will say I think in Man on Fire, there were problems I have with it. What's interesting about Man on Fire is that Denzel's playing a far more complex
yes.
character than in Training Day.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really the in-between. It's the
right.
in-between between the very noble Denzel that we're used to and the Training Day. It's that gray area in between that he's playing in Man on Fire. But we are on the subject of his visual flair, and particularly Man on Fire. Last year when we did our Art of Cinematography series, we spoke to a cinematographer that Paul Cameron, whose new movie Total Recall is in theaters now, but he shot two movies for Tony Scott. He shot Man on Fire and Deja Vu, and he also shot movies for Dominic Sena. And if you think about the look of a Tony Scott film, I don't think any other director defined the look of movies more than he did in the 80s. Because, I mean, he defined definitely the look of all Bruckheimer movies,
mm-hmm.
no matter who directed them.
Yeah,
I mean,
true.
They took Tony Scott's blueprint and they said, make it look like this, you know. But this guy had shot two movies for Tony Scott, and he talked a little bit about working with him. So I want to play this clip of his insights.
And then working with Tony Scott, Tony was much different because we were exploring, certainly on Man on Fire, we explored a lot of hand crank cameras and using reversal film and with a special photographic process. We were developing a style of photography and color that was coming out of Denzel's character's psychological state of you know, being kind of a depressed alcoholic. So,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, he goes through these spells. We wanted this photography in this world to come out of that.
Let me show you what I got here. See this? This is a charger used by convicts to hide money and drugs. They stick it in their body. They tuck it up their rectum. You familiar with that? This. Look at me. Pencil detonator. Timer. Used as a receiver, transmitter. C4. Highly explosive. You put them all together, you got a bomb. Not very sophisticated, but very powerful. That's what you have in your ass right now. Don't move. Don't move. Don't move.
Well, I understand from Tony Scott's shooting style that he's very unique, that he covers things with a lot of cameras, doesn't he?
Yeah. It's, you know, the one thing working with Tony Scott is, you know, the very beginning, I could tell right away he wanted to use multi-cameras, you know, 2-3 cameras, you know, then the next project, 3-4 cameras, and the next film, you know, 5-6 cameras, and then suddenly cameras just everywhere, and you know, it's kind of daunting at first, because, you know, you feel like, you know, how, you know, can I concentrate on the shot, you know, or telling the story, and then, you know, in the process of kind of learning his style, letting go, I learned a lot from his approach, and what I grew to admire, and I've still employed a lot in, you know, later films, is, you know, the use of multi-cameras and kind of the freedom of not worrying about exact eye lines and exact matching angles and you know, a lot of the things that govern filmmaking in a very traditional way, Tony kind of broke away from. So it's extremely liberating. You know, it can kind of be dangerous, and it can feel unfamiliar to a lot of filmmakers. But you know, I still love getting, you know, 3-4 angles of almost the same shot at the same time, as long as we can, you know, we've got the manpower and the cameras to do it. You know, because yeah. you never know. It's like a slight profile shot where you get a glint in the eye, or you know, a tear coming out of an eye or something on a profile as opposed to a front shot is, you know, can have a dynamic to it visually and emotionally that, you know, that's kind of a surprise later.
And that's another thing about using all of those multiple cameras, is that usually an actor in a film, like an experienced film actor, and certainly he worked with all the best, many of the best, they generally know, okay, what am I playing to? What lens are you using? What camera? You know, they know how to gauge their performance based on that. So when you have a multitude of cameras, really, I mean, that kind of takes that pressure off. And just act the scene with your partner, and no matter what, we're going to catch it. You know, we've got you covered. And that's a unique way of working, all those multiple cameras. I mean, I think he talks about it in the commentary for Unstoppable, and the sheer number of cameras he has embedded in that train. I mean, he's catching everything, which also means that he's got a terribly good editor in his movies.
Not only that, but I mean, let's talk about one thing, another aspect that I think is pretty important. A lot of these obits that are popping up, considerations of his work by a lot of critics, some of them are kind of struggling because, you know, like I said, you know, he wasn't out for critical acclaim. But can we just talk about what an amazing director he was of casting?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just True Romance and Crimson Tide alone, if you look at the you know, I mean, you got the leads, but if you look at the supporting players, mm-hmm. you know, players who only have one scene, two scenes. I mean, they're some of their best. And then Enemy of the State is another one, has a lot of key players playing hackers and so forth. Days of Thunder has a lot of people on the pit crew, to Pelham and Deja Vu and all that stuff. Spy Game. And The Fan has a, I mean, The Fan, you know, people don't, you know, they don't talk about it that much. I describe it as kind of a Grindhouse ripoff of Taxi Driver, and on that basis,
that's actually pretty good. Actually.
He doesn't. I don't think one of the things he's not getting credit for is his eye for casting. I mean,
well, and he, I mean, he made Tom Cruise a massive superstar.
Yes, he did.
He built the biggest superstar we've had, mm-hmm. or we have today. You know,
mm-hmm.
and he pretty much he gave Christopher Walken and Dennis Hopper, yes. second, you know, final acts in their careers, or at least in Hopper's case, another final act.
Mm-hmm.
With Walken, he pretty much elevated him to the Walken that we know.
it's a fact. Yeah. You see, Sicilians have black blood pumping through their hearts. And no, if you don't believe me, you can look it up. Hundreds and hundreds of years ago, the Moors conquered Sicily. See, way back then, Sicilians were like wops from northern Italy. They all had blonde hair and blue eyes. But, then the Moors moved in there, and, they changed the whole country. It was Sicilian women, huh? That they changed the whole bloodline forever. That's why blonde hair and blue eyes became black hair and dark skin. Now, this... I'm quoting history. It's written. It's a fact. It's written.
I love this guy.
And I think of another movie that he did that I've always had a soft spot for, and that's Revenge.
Yeah.
I've always liked Revenge. And I think one of the characteristics that pops out most to me about Tony Scott films is the macho quality of them. And so you have Golden Boy Costner going up against and getting down and dirty in that movie, and going up against, you know, Anthony Quinn. I mean, how more visceral a presence can you get than Anthony Quinn?
Right.
I mean, he just sticks his chest out, and you're like, oh my God, it's like you're imposing as hell. And I do love that dynamic between the two of them.
I ask you now as a man and a former friend to ask my forgiveness for taking my wife away from me.
I ask your forgiveness for taking your wife away from you.
Revenge is an interesting film in that it's essentially a three-character piece.
Mm-hmm.
But probably, you really have to go to, you have to flash forward all the way to Unstoppable, where it's, you know, Denzel and Chris Pine in the train car that is back and forth.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, you know, as massive as Unstoppable is, you know, those train car scenes are pretty intimate. But, you know, Revenge is just this love triangle and this kind of very passionate, you know, melodrama. You know, it's a Tony Scott version of a melodrama. That's
mm-hmm.
his version of what a romantic, violent melodrama would be.
Of Tarantino's favorite movies, right?
Yes, it is. I mean, yeah. It was on a commentary. I can't remember which one. Where Tarantino says, you know, whenever Tony's like in pre-production, he doesn't take his calls because Tony is the only guy he can't say no to, and he knows Tony's going to call him to ask him to do rewrites. Because he did an uncredited rewrite on Crimson Tide. Because obviously he loved him, what he did for True Romance. So he's like, I know when Tony calls, he wants me to do a rewrite, so I don't take his calls because I like the money. He said, I like the money I got for rewriting, but I don't want to do it anymore. Tony's the only guy I can't say no to. And to the point, I mean, Tarantino's script of True Romance, he had, you know, Christian Slater dying. And the story goes that when Tony Scott brought Christian Slater back, you know, originally Tarantino was like, no, don't. And the thing he told Tony was, Revenge, man. Remember the ending of Revenge? I want the ending to Revenge on the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he saw it, he's like, okay, it works. I see your point. The other story, Tarantino, I remember when he was, the story I heard when he was in Park City in 92 with Reservoir Dogs, he was kind of alone because he wanted to, you know, everyone there was kind of, you know, uppity about talking about cinema and film. And he's like, man, I read a quote that said, I couldn't find anyone who wanted to talk about Revenge or Days of Thunder. He's like, those are the cool movies I want to talk about, but no one... no one in Park City was wanting to talk about those types of movies.
I think about True Romance too, and there's an element of it that it's kind of a young teenager's version of what would be a really cool love story. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a lot of James Dean and Elvis Presley and all the violence
right.
and guns and drugs and the coolest girlfriend in the world that stands by you no matter what. There's this kind of very youthful, sweet exuberance in the movie, surrounded by this like incredible violence. You know?
She's a hooker, but she's only had like 3 clients in 4 days.
Right.
Not that bad. She hasn't been used that much, so she's still reputable as a human being.
You know, and you posted something like a defense of his place in movies and his particular style and voice.
Mm-hmm.
And the first person that responded was, you know, when he had a great script, he made a good movie. But you know, essentially, that he wasn't all that. But I mean, my point is, doesn't everybody kind of require a great script to make a great?
Yeah, you do need it. I mean, it is.
Is that like an epiphany? You know, you can make a great movie if you got a great script. I mean, nobody says, here's a shitty script. I'm sure you can make a great movie out of it. I mean, it brings out the best in anyone.
Yeah.
A great script.
Yeah.
And the clearest example of that is my least favorite Tony Scott film is Beverly Hills Cop 2. Because, obviously it had a script.
Right.
But you can literally see where they're like, okay, now we need this scene. Now we need this scene.
Mm-hmm.
Now Eddie needs to do this. Eddie needs to do this. Okay, we need a chase. We need a shootout. We need a one-liner. And it's just so paint by numbers. And the biggest problem in Beverly Hills Cop 2, just beyond a bad script, is that Eddie, you know, Axel Foley, Eddie Murphy, is not in conflict with the establishment. You know, that was the thing about, that was the fun about Beverly Hills Cop was Axel Foley, down and dirty ghetto cop from Detroit, disrupting the Beverly Hills high
out of his element. Yeah.
Yeah. Now Beverly Hills Cop 2, he knows his way around. He's got the two Beverly Hills cops on his side, so he's not really up against anything. So.
Well, at that point, I mean, he started. He always wanted to be a feature director, and I'm sure he very much looked up to his brother, and he worked a lot in commercials and music videos, and he did The Hunger, and The Hunger did not do well.
No, not
even
not
though in a lot of circles it was very well received critically, and that, if you talk about a mood piece, I think it's drenched.
Oh yeah, dude. I mean, that's like,
I mean, that's incredibly like moody.
It's
yeah, and it's not even about. I mean, that movie is not about story. I mean, you could tell that's about the visual experience,
mm-hmm.
and what right. that emits to an audience. But then he was very, you know, he was down. That movie tanked, and it was a couple of years. And I guess Simpson Bruckheimer saw The Hunger, but they also saw a commercial he made where I think a race car like tries to outrun a jet.
Yeah.
And they said, we want him for Top Gun.
Excuse me, Lieutenant. Is there something wrong?
Yes, ma'am. The data on the MiG is inaccurate.
How's that, Lieutenant?
Well, I just happened to see a MiG-28. We happened to see a MiG-28 do a 4G negative dive.
Where did you see this?
That's classified.
What?
It's classified. I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
Lieutenant, I have top secret clearance. The Pentagon sees to it that I know more than you.
Well, ma'am, it doesn't seem so in this case now, does it?
So, Lieutenant, where exactly were you?
Well, we started up on his 6 when he pulled through the clouds, and then I moved in above him.
Well, if you were directly above him, how could you see him?
Because I was inverted.
Colton! No, he was, man. It was a really great move. He was inverted.
And I think he was very shrewd. He looked at it, he said, I can make this a big hit. I mean, I know why this sells, and I know how to sell it. And so when that became a huge hit, I mean, he's a big commercial director now. He's made one of the biggest smashes ever, started a big phenomenon. And so I think that they thought he's perfect to further cement Eddie Murphy's kind of action hero superstardom. And I do think that Beverly Hills Cop was completely programmed from the beginning to build Eddie Murphy as a big action star at the sacrifice of the actual movie. You know, I think that's probably kind of what you're saying.
And he does Days of Thunder, which was a rush job and got hyped as Top Gun on wheels, Top Gun and NASCAR. And, you know, the funny thing is, I think, oddly enough, critics probably gave Days of Thunder probably a little more praise than, well, I know they gave a little more praise than the audience did. And the thing is about Days of Thunder, well, it is pretty much Top Gun Redux. The difference is that Robert Towne is doing the screenplay, so you do have some lines and some nicely etched kind of, you know, B-movie style characters. You know, Robert Duvall's a character. Michael Rooker's a character. John C. Reilly's a character. Carrie Always is a character. Nicole Kidman is far and away better than Kelly McGillis in the female role. And that's because, you know, Robert Towne basically, you know, like, look, we're doing Top Gun on wheels, but you can do it.
And he knew that no one would do those iconic moments better than he did. And when I think of Days of Thunder, I mean, the first image that pops in my mind is the first time we see Tom Cruise, and he's riding his motorcycle through the fog, through the smoke on the NASCAR track. And it's, I mean, that image knows what it is. I mean, that's built to be an iconic star entrance, and it's one of the great star entrances, actually. He was great at casting.
Let's Duvall hop into the race car.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love that. He's giving a monologue to the race car. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the best audience he's ever had.
People don't know, that movie humanized Michael Rooker because he was coming off of Sea of Love and Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Right.
So we finally got a sympathetic Michael Rooker.
Yeah, no small feat there.
Yeah, that is quite an accomplishment. That is
I love Michael Rooker. He's a good guy.
Yes, he is.
What do you think, Rick? What do you think of Spy Game?
I liked it okay. I mean, I thought it was okay. I mean, I saw it. I thought it was interesting. It was kind of. It wasn't one of my favorites. It's definitely shot like a Tony Scott movie. You know, you can tell he's got multiple cameras. It's interestingly paced, very visual.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not one of my favorites.
Well, it's like I guess it's one of those where he loved to work with kind of gorgeous movie stars. And so,
right. Well, he got two of them, right?
Brad Pitt.
I know.
Robert Redford, yeah.
I mean, this great combo. But when I think of Spy Game, I think of the story that Redford always told. And I know that I've told you this story before, Rick, but Redford was talking about working with Tony Scott, and he said, I just wanted to know how he shoots movies. I just wanted to be around that. Because that method of shooting movies with multiple cameras and all that kind of stuff is completely foreign to me. So he was doing the rooftop scene, and they had cameras everywhere. And they had a helicopter, like, flying around them, and there was a camera mounted on the helicopter. And Redford was just, like, looking around and thinking, I've never been in something like this before. You know, just like this odd observer of Tony Scott and his method of working.
Nathan, what happened? What went wrong? Nothing. Nothing. Actually, one thing. Don't ever question me again. Ever. What? I give you an order, you take it. You don't ask why. Those 10 seconds on the phone could have blown the op.
The op was bringing Schmidt across.
The op was setting up Ann Cathcart, and your end had to look legit.
What are you telling me? Schmidt was bait?
Yes.
Nathan, they executed him on a shitty cellar floor.
And it could have been you. Let me tell you something about Schmidt. He went to the Russians a week ago and said he had a contact, an American, somebody he could use.
Don't tell me that. Don't fucking tell me that. You didn't look in his eyes. Don't tell me that.
Earlier today, I talked to Brian Tyler, but And I talked to him for Expendables 2 because he just scored Expendables 2, and that's what he was coming on to promote. But I was talking to him, I looked over his resume, and he provided additional music for Unstoppable. And so I asked him about Tony Scott, and I wanted to play what he had to say about him because I think it illuminates some ways in which Tony Scott has had an enormous influence and will continue to have a great influence on film. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask because, I mean, I saw earlier today, I saw that you were credited for doing some work on Unstoppable. Did you do work on Unstoppable?
I, in fact, that's interesting that you noticed that. Yeah, that's because Tony passed away, and it's so sad. And my contact with him was on Unstoppable, and it was. I mean, I've been a fan of his, forever since I was a kid. And when it came to that, I don't remember the circumstances exactly, but there's some scenes in there, a big chunk of some, I don't know, it was like the action sequence at the end and all that, where they wanted to use my music, some music that I'd already written, actually. Mm. So that ended up happening, and it worked great, and it worked really well with Harry's music, and it just kind of was a cool thing, a big honor, too, to just be in a Tony Scott film, and it was, so then, it's strange, those things, and then you all of a sudden you get a phone call in the morning, like, hey, did you hear, mm. And
did you have a chance to meet him ever?
Yeah, he's awesome, an intense friendly guy, funny guy, like old school, real director, super talented. And,
very much, yeah. we're paying tribute to his films tonight, actually.
Oh,
and thinking about the music that accompanied his films, I mean, I think just in terms of the modern action film as we know it today, he had a major role in defining it.
Yeah.
But also musically. I mean, the musical voice to the action genre, he had a major role in that as well, I think.
Huge, huge. Totally not to be underestimated, And, I mean, and it started off very interestingly, too. I think it was The Hunger was first, right? Or
yes.
And then, to go into doing things like, obviously Top Gun, and then moving into the whole milieu that he, all the films he worked on with Harry and Hans and it's such a, defines kind of the modern action vibe. And he was so good at kind of, I think, encouraging composers to do a certain something, that, mm-hmm. that always seemed to capture the vibe of the movie. And it's funny because it is so true that you associate this type of music and the sound with his movies, and at the same time, the guy was pegged early on, just like his brother, as being a pure visual guy, coming from cinematography and coming from doing, commercials and things like that, that the knock on him was that the stuff was so pretty that he shot. It just looked unbelievably cool,
mm-hmm.
But it really lent itself to great music because these visuals opened up enough space that it wasn't just it opened enough space that it wasn't just explosions. The stuff looked great. It almost looked like it kind of fooled you into thinking, wow, this is like this eye candy special effects film. When you look at it, it was just the way he'd pick his lens and light a scene, and that was his greatest special effect, was his eye. And so you were able to do music without tons of sound effects going on all the time. I mean, there were those scenes, of course. But and so you had those moments where you could, you all of a sudden hear, and it's like these shots, these long shots, these long lens shots with the beautiful amber, sunny hue, and it left room for really cool music, an indelible mark.
It's so iconic. And I think about, you do think about big action films and Tony Scott, but you think, you look at Crimson Tide and you think of that as a big action film, but
yeah.
It's two great actors in a submarine going.
Submarine,
ahead.
I know.
The Unstoppable, two guys on a train.
Yeah.
You know, incredible.
Same guy, Denzel and both. And the score is so cool for Crimson Tide, you know, and that kind of, in a way, was a turning point also, like what we know as kind of this era of, motif-driven scores with mm-hmm. that kind of sound. It was kind of the one that popularized it to me, at least.
I think so, too.
With Crimson Tide.
Yeah.
You know? And then all the way through, you know, actually like Deja Vu, just and all, you know, with kind of refining it through the years and again, kind of always worked on his craft. It was the guy was, he was something else.
So that's Brian Tyler. His full interview will air next week, but I wanted to play that clip of him talking about Tony Scott.
I think I said on Facebook, Jamie, I think you saw, where, I think Hans Zimmer's scores for True Romance and Crimson Tide, those are career highlights for me.
Yes. Yes.
They're just...
Well, yeah.
So.
Even the orchestral score on, Days of Thunder is really good, too. And, I think, Aaron brought up earlier that he was good at casting. And realistically, he was really good at, finding composers that really went along with his films, too. So.
And he had people that were very loyal to him. I think he had a core crew that always
yes,
kind of relished the idea of working with him. And you see it in the actors, too. He used the same actors multiple times.
Yeah.
And so it really felt like kind of a repertory of
mm-hmm.
of collaborators that he had in his pocket.
He kind of referred to them as like his second family.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah,
very true.
I think the DP on Unstoppable started off as like, the assistant or the slate clapper, 22 years ago. You don't. I haven't heard any. I'm sure there are, but as jocular and as testosterone filled some of his sets were obviously were. It's funny. I haven't heard a story yet of I didn't get along with him.
No. Yeah.
Ridley's had problems with actors, probably more than Tony.
And actually, many of his actresses came out today and talked about, this is the sweetest man I've ever worked for. Yeah. Something else comes to mind, too, when we're talking about the directors that owe a lot to Tony Scott's style and are desperate to make Tony Scott films and can't. I would put Michael Bay in that category, actually.
Yeah, they get the surface, they duplicate the surface, but no one wants to acknowledge that Tony Scott had a genius for streamlining stories.
I want to bring up two things in closing.
Yep.
And one of them has to do with racism.
Oh God,
oddly,
here we go.
Oddly enough. Because I posted that Crimson Tide. That's probably my favorite Tony Scott film. That and Unstoppable. But my good friend said they really took out all the racism that was in that script. And my thought on that was, I'm so glad that they did, because for me, Crimson Tide works because these two actors are going head to head. You know, in real life, these two actors have a tremendous respect for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a feeling, a sense, that even though they are at odds and they disagree fundamentally about their mission and what it should be, that they have a respect for each other as characters. And I think the moment you put race into that, it automatically weakens one of those characters.
True.
They see each other on terms of on kind of equal terms.
Right.
I would say that you don't have to put racism in the script or racial element in the script. Let's just say you don't have to put a racial element into the script. Let's not call it racial, just a racial element into the script, because the fact that you have a white superior officer and a black subordinate, okay, already there, it's already there. So you don't have to announce what's already there. And yes, they are two characters.
We're talking about a filmmaker that people criticize for being too excessive. And right. Then when I bring up Crimson Tide, which I think is his best movie, they yeah. criticize him for not being obvious enough. So that's my point. I think it only strengthens that movie. Possibly that undercurrent is there. I think that's probably something that the audience brings to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it only benefits the movie not to have that explicitly expressed. Actually, the weakest part of the movie to me is when it is expressed in that horse back and forth exchange that Tarantino wrote for it.
That's the thing, though. Tony Scott, in his film, whenever he's done these black and white characters, be it Last Boy Scout, be it Crimson Tide, be it The Fan, and be it Unstoppable, people talk about his excess. And the thing that's excessive is I don't consider it mostly excessive, because he's usually telling stories that involve characters under duress in extreme situations.
So to be
restrained would just be kind of counterproductive. But also when you're dealing with extreme situations, you don't have time to parse out racial animosity.
I can easily see any other director, and I'm not saying that all directors would do this, but I can easily see a lot of directors going in and playing that up. But the second Gene Hackman would express something like that, he would lose major ground. It would not be the Clash of the Titans that movie is right now.
Oh.
I mean, he would lose moral footing. And what makes that movie so powerful is that you understand where they stand, and you sympathize completely with both points of view.
Captain? Captain EAM. What do you think?
I think there's nothing on this.
Yes, sir. It got cut off during the attack.
Then it's meaningless.
Sir, this is an EAM pertaining to nuclear missile.
No, Mr. Hunter. That's a message fragment.
Because it got cut off during the attack, so the message can mean anything. It can be a message to a board, it can be a message...
It could be a fake Russian transmission.
Which is exactly why we need to confirm, sir. All I'm asking for is the time we need to get back online.
Calm down, Mr. Hunter.
I am calm.
You don't appear to be calm.
Calm weapons. Missile systems ready to launch in 4 minutes.
Step aside, sir.
Yes, sir.
We have orders in hand. And those orders to make a preemptive launch. Every second that we lose increases the chances that by the time our missiles arrive, their silos could be empty because they flew in their birds and struck us first.
Yes, sir.
You know as well as I do that any launch order received without authentication is no order at all.
Yes,
that's our number one rule.
That rule
is the basis for the scenario we've trained on time and time again.
Yes, sir.
It's a rule we follow without exception.
Captain, National Military Command Center knows what sector we're in. They have satellites looking down on us to see if our birds are aloft, and if they're not... Then they give our orders to somebody else. That's why we maintain more than one sub. It's what they call redundancy.
I know about redundancy, Mr. Hunter.
All I'm saying, Captain, is that we have backup. Now, it's our duty not to launch until we can confirm.
You're presuming that we have other submarines out there ready to launch. But as Captain, I must assume that our submarines could have been taken out by other Akulas. We can play these games all night, Mr. Hunter, but I don't have the luxury of your presumptions.
Sir.
Mr. Hunter... We have rules that are not open to interpretation, personal intuition, gut feelings, hairs on the back of your neck, little devils or angels sitting on your shoulders.
Captain.
We're all very well aware of what our orders are and what those orders mean. They come down from our commander-in-chief. They contain no ambiguity.
Captain.
Mr. Hunter, I've made a decision. I'm captain of this boat. Now shut the fuck up!
The last thing that I want to say about Tony Scott is there's going to be a lot of... We're already seeing it. There's going to be a lot of intellectual snobism about Tony Scott. But what makes Tony Scott unique and what all movies could use more of, including the artists with a capital A,
mm-hmm.
is a sense of energy, a sense of momentum, a sense of, my God, I'm making a movie It's so exciting. Mm-hmm. I love this more than anything in life. At Tony Scott's best, he made bad movies, mediocre movies. He made a few great movies. Throughout, you always got that sense about him. And that's what I think, personally, I will cherish most about Tony mm-hmm. Scott's movies.
I agree.
I will happily, like, you give me a Tony Scott film to watch, right? A choice between a Tony Scott film and the latest Bellatar movie.
yeah.
I'm gonna take the Tony Scott film.
Oh yeah,
it doesn't even have to be True Romance or Crimson Tide. They're like, do you want to see The Fan or do you want to see the latest Bellatar?
And for all the bombast, he loved actors, and actors loved him. Watch Crimson Tide. Watch Unstoppable. I mean, those are actors.
Spy Game, for that matter. I mean,
absolutely. Spy Game, a massive kind of canvas that he's working on,
mm-hmm.
and it's this decades long kind of at the root very intimate story between mentor and protege. I mean, that's the heart of it. All right, guys. I really appreciate you taking part in this. This is going to air later tonight.
I wish it was under happier circumstances, but
well, I think that we were happy celebrating his movies and celebrating
right.
what we thought what we feel about him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the celebration. We're going to close with a piece of score from one of his films. This is Jack Nietzsche and his score from Revenge. Thank you, guys, and good night.
Good night.
Thank you.